Write yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yes, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, the show, Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to address the question, is another financial crisis coming? Everything seems relatively stable if you read the business press, right? And you get a hype almost every day that, the U.S. economy is getting better. And, this Greece situation has been put to bed. And, the big crash that came here in the Chinese stocks has been stabilized. It's all over. We're about to approach a period of sustained economic growth. Jobs in the U.S., unemployment down to 5.5%. And recently, unemployment insurance claims at lowest levels in a long time. And, wages are increasing. Yeah, it all sounds pretty rosy, doesn't it? Look behind and below the propaganda and the hype. And what do we see? The global economy is not really doing all that well. Let's look behind the figures, because the front page figures, they pick and choose the best data they can and put a spin on it to make it look better, because they hope that by influencing public confidence, it will actually influence the results that aren't so great. Okay, what's happening? China. Well, China came out last week and said, 7% GDP growth. We hit our targets. It's all not that bad, even though you had a 30% collapse in China stocks before the Chinese government intervened with extraordinary measures, pumped hundreds of billions of dollars to try to stop this collapse, and temporarily did. But anybody who knows anything about China stock markets knows that this is not sustainable. China stocks went up 120% in 1 year, engineered to a great extent by the government. I'll explain how that happened. And now, of course, what goes up that fast comes down even faster. And we had, since the middle of June, this collapse in China stocks. And it's been temporarily stabilized. Temporarily. All experts know that this stock correction is not over in China. And what are the real economic repercussions of this, we'll talk about. Most experts realize that this 7% China GDP rate is nowhere near 7%. Most of your big bank research companies, or arms, indicate that it's probably between 4 and 5%. Okay. And if you drop below 5.5% in China, in terms of GDP, then you are getting layoffs in China. Well, if you look at China's real economy, better indicators are electricity usage and so forth. And if you look at consumer sales, auto sales have collapsed. In just a year, from a 15 to 20% growth rate, it's flat. In other words, no increase going on in auto sales. And that was a big indicator of the so-called shift to consumption that China's been trying to do. You know, in previous years, and in the wake of the 2008 crisis, it was massive government investment, particularly into construction of all kinds, industrial construction, housing construction, so forth, that pumped up the economy to double-digit GDP growth rates. And left all kind of Potemkin village projects everywhere. There are almost entire cities, small towns, where there's hardly anybody there, but there's a beautiful infrastructure and apartment buildings and shopping malls and so forth, but they're ghost cities. China has been trying to move away from that massive government investment. It was a great strategy to avoid the collapse that the rest of the industrial world went through in the wake of the 2008 recession. But it's not sustainable because you've got to turn to other ways to get long-term growth. And, of course, China has also been historically, in recent times, very dependent on manufacturing and export sales. Right? If you look at manufacturing and export, manufacturing has been contracting. That's a very important part of that economy. Government private investment has been slowing so that it didn't have to overproduce once again. So the whole shift has been towards consumption. But as I just said, consumption was beginning to look pretty weak. And now this stock market crash is going to really take another bite out of consumption in China. So with manufacturing and exports down and consumption now slowing and government slowing, where do we get 7% growth? Nowhere. You can't get 7% growth out of these conditions, right? Okay, so that's the real economy in China. Really, about two-thirds of what's originally reported is slowing rapidly from its 10 to 14% growth rates in 2010-12. As I've said elsewhere, big changes began to occur around 2013 in China, and China has been attempting to deal with a dilemma, and that dilemma is how do we check the growing influence of shadow banks, Western shadow banks, in speculating and causing these bubbles in China, first in overproducing old industrial plants, and second in construction, local government, construction projects, infrastructure, and so forth, housing, residential, and so forth, created bubbles, and asset management products, speculative bubbles, and China's whole strategy was let's take this money out of these sectors that are causing bubbles and put it in our stock market. Let's get all these get rich quick, and there are many of them in China who've gotten rich off of the boom in China since 1999, and super rich off of the speculative bubbles that have appeared since 2010. Now, let's try to redirect that money and have it flow into the stock market, the Chinese stock market. And the whole idea there was if you flow it into the stock market, the stock prices of these Chinese companies will rise, and it will make the Chinese companies more inclined to invest and expand. You know, their stock is rising. That means more equity financing, and let's expand. And that way the government would not have to invest so much in direct investment, government investment. The private sector would take over some of this direct investment. That's the strategy. That was the strategy, and still, to some extent, is the strategy. But the problem with that strategy is it just moves the bubbles around. You know, we went from a... China went from a local housing construction a bubble and over-financing of old industrial plants, meaning plants making steel, mining, and so on and so forth, right? And therefore demanding all these commodities from around the world, or iron ore and so forth from Australia and other commodities from South America, etc., big demand in China, expanding these old industries, industrial plants, expanding their operation, and now, of course, with the global economy and China slowing down, they got all this unused capacity in their industrial base there, and that's causing problems, particularly the least efficient of these Chinese industrial companies can't compete, so they're in big trouble. Does the government allow them to go under, or does the government subsidize them? That's the big question. If they go under, they've been borrowing a lot of money. In the meantime, corporate bond money, junk bond money, what's the contagion effects if they do allow them to go under. It's a big risk. So China's been sort of walking the tightrope on these old industrial companies and trying to keep them going. Doesn't want to precipitate defaults. There have been a few. At the same time, China, all this direct investment, government investment themselves cannot be sustained forever. And they want to shift towards a more consumer-oriented economy. So the government doesn't have to subsidize as much and invest as much. And at the local level, of course, the same thing happened with local governments funding real estate borrowing, a lot of it from Western money, a lot of it from money from shadow banks flowing into China after 2010, causing the bubble in the local market. So China has been trying to contain these bubbles, but every time it tries to contain the bubbles, it slows down the real economy. Monetary policy is very blunt in that sense. You know, central bank policy, raising, lowering interest rate, reserve requirements, etc., typical tools of central banks to stop these bubbles, but it also slows down the rest of the economy. So China's been going back and forth trying to deal with this dilemma. And the whole idea of trying to redirect all this excess liquidity and money into the stock market, China's stock market, was a way of sucking the money out of these other bubbles and therefore allowing the government to contain these other bubbles. But what it did was create a bubble in the stock market. Now, China, wanted to boost its stock market because it wants to add its Shanghai and Shenzhen markets, stock markets, equity markets, to this global emerging markets stock market called the MSCI. China's making a number of initiatives globally in a number of directions, as we've seen. They create the Asian Industrial Bank, and a lot of countries around the world joined into that, including Europeans and Britain and so forth, to the consternation of the U.S. Elite, of course, but nonetheless, capitalists go where the money is. And that was a great opportunity. And then the creation of this BRIC bank, same thing, challenges to the World Bank by China itself, and a way of linking other countries economically to it, but also politically. And in the process, raising the possibility of the Chinese yuan currency as a parallel global reserve currency to the dollar and the pound. And this means great economic power and political influence for China if it can do that. So all this putting money or redirecting all this money capital in China into the stock market is part of this broader financial strategy of creating world banks and creating global currency, establishing what's called the Silk Road, direct overland trade routes through Russia to Europe. China's investing a lot of money in Europe, both in the periphery, in Eastern Europe, and a lot of money, Chinese money, going into infrastructure in the UK. So China has been courting Europe as a way of linking it closer to itself economically and thus politically. As I said before, you know, the U.S. made a big mistake in precipitating a coup in the Ukraine. In a way of challenging Russia, because Russia economically is not the real challenge and threat to the United States. Economically, the big challenge is China. So American neocons stupidly provoked a situation in the Ukraine in order to create a crisis there, to use it as an excuse to put sanctions on Russia, to separate Russia's growing trade relationships with Germany and with Western Europe. And so far the U.S. has succeeded with that in partially isolating Russia. But, the West, Western Europeans, Germans aren't totally stupid, and they're circumventing a lot of these sanctions and cutting deals with the Russians. But, you know, it's this big focus on Russia economically and politically that is really a history will show a big strategic bad move by the U.S. They should be focusing more on China from their own capitalist interest. I'm not saying that personally, but from their own capitalist interest. China is the much bigger challenge to U.S. hegemony economically and, of course, politically in the world. Obama's pivot to China is really all part of this, right? And this rapid push to conclude the Trans-Pacific trade deal, TPP, is also part of that. You know, if Obama hadn't gotten fast-tracked, that would have been another big defeat for the whole reorientation to China that the U.S. is also trying to undertake. I think there's a wing of the American ruling class that understands China is the major challenge, and that's what this whole pivot is about. But we've got these neocons entrenched in the State Department and elsewhere, and I think they precipitated this Ukraine thing. By the way, Ukraine is about the default. When that crisis erupted, the IMF put in $17 billion. I said they need more than $50 billion to bail that out, and that might not be enough. That was two years ago, I think, in the February. It's past February. And ever since then, of course, the Ukraine economy has collapsed. You know, its currency has collapsed. It has no currency exchange reserves of any note. The U.S. and Europeans put their bankers directly in charge of running the economy. It's just an economic satrapy of the United States and Western Europe right now. And, of course, then you got that political fight going on in the eastern region there. And they are about to default on their IMF debt. IMF is holding out another 20-some billion, so getting close to 50 billion, I said, but, they want even more austerity in the Ukraine. And you still have some private investors involved there, Franklin Templeton and others, and they're refusing to take a haircut. Unlike in the case in Greece, when the private investors were bailed out, paid off, and allowed to largely exit back in the 2012 bailout of Greece. So that the recent crisis in Greece here is not really about private investors, it's government-to-government investors. But we've talked a lot about that Greece situation, and we will continue. We're waiting to see what the bailout terms and deal might be. It may not be as easy as people think. This crisis has not ended in Greece by any imagination, and it will continue. And we'll see by August 20th, when some more money is due for payments, what that situation is. And we'll talk more about the collapse of Syriza, the party there, and what that all signifies, as I've been saying, for months now in my many shows and writings on Greece, that the real the real challenge here is the real conflict is between an attempt to reestablish old European social democracy in terms of policies versus new European neoliberalism. And the neoliberals really run by Germans, Dutch, and so forth are no way going to, I predicted, no way would allow a restoration of social democracy with social benefits and so forth. That was the case of the demands of Syriza. So Syriza had to go. And there's either one or two ways of getting Syriza to go, and that is get Syriza to destroy itself by accepting the deal that it did, which is in progress. It will. Or get Syriza to lead in a Grexit, an exit, by not accepting the austerity. And then, of course, the Northern Europeans, the Germans, and so forth would totally destroy the Greek banking system, which they were prepared to do, and cause a severe economic crisis, even worse than the depression they've been in. And thereafter, maneuver new political parties, new formations, and get a government in there to replace Syriza if Syriza did not abandon its principles. replace it with another after an economic crisis. You know, this is typically what the West always does. If it's got a recalcitrant political regime in there, you just collapse the economy through many ways and then fund the opponents and get a government in there to replace them. And if necessary, you use the local military to help carry that out. But what happened here in the case of Syriza is that it capitulated, or at least Tsipras, the prime minister, capitulated. And that will lead to a split in the left wing, and Syriza will move to the right in terms of its policies and compositions. That's already beginning. Which means Syriza's dead, which means you've got another New Democracy Party, PASOK Party, which is really going along with neoliberalism and all the austerity that accompanies neoliberalism. Okay, so that's the situation in Greece. We'll be talking more about that because there's no way Greece can extract itself from this situation without massive growth rates consistently for decades, which isn't going to happen. 4% growth rate in Greece is just fantasy. It's fantasy in Europe. It's not going to happen in Europe, so it's not going to happen in Greece. So there's no way they can grow out of this thing. And the Germans, the fight that's coming is being led by the Germans now, particularly this guy, Wolfgang Schäuble, who has won. He's the big winner here, particularly in Germany, in his challenge to Merkel. And Merkel, of course, capitulated went along with him. So the bankers are running German policy, of course, and Merkel is just tagging along as well, because they've manufactured German public opinion to think that a Greek bailout means they're going to have to pay more, which is absolutely not true. But anyway, Schäuble and the German bankers have won in Germany, and now they're fighting another fight here in the case of Greece because, the bankers wanted Greece to leave. Schäuble, Grexit was his number one proposal and has been his idea since 2012. The fight is still going on, and Schäuble and the bankers in Germany are going to press to prevent any additional loans to Greece. And probably what you see is just in stretching out of the debt in Greece, make it 50 or 60 years, lower the annual payments, maybe lower interest rate. But now they don't want to loan anymore to Greece. Greece has agreed to all the austerity, and they probably will not get any more money. For all the austerity, from now to forever, that's been imposed on them. In fact, the austerity provisions are even worse today than they were before the expiration of this agreement back in February. Even more stringent. And, of course, they set up this fund, $55 billion fund, in which the Europeans are going to sell off all the assets of the Greeks, right, to help pay the interest on the debt that they loaned Greece so Greece could buy German exports. Anyway, that's a long story. I will have a book coming out on this in the next couple of months called Europe's Greek Tragedy by Clarity Press. We'll talk more about that when the dust clears here later in August. And then, of course, after that, almost for sure, you'll have re-elections in Greece, and the party alignments will change, and Syriza will solidify as a party more of a coalition of center-right rather than left-to-center. Okay, so that's Greece. And China. What about Japan? What's the picture look like in Japan? Japan's economy is flat again. They say it's about 0.6% GDP growth this year. I don't even believe that. Japan is on its typical trajectory that it has been for over a decade now of deflation and repeated moderate recessions. despite the fact that they put a massive QE, quantitative easing, monetary injection in place here at the end of 2013-14. Okay, massive, even bigger than the U.S. as a percentage of GDP. Well, what did they get? They got a big stock surge, a stock market surge for a while, about 70%. So stocks did well. Their currency declined, so exporters, Japanese exporters, and investors sent their money offshore. They did not expand domestically their operations. They reinvested offshore, which is typical of what happens with these massive QE and monetary injections by central banks, right? It flows into the financial markets, and it flows offshore to, higher profit real investment opportunities. So financial investment domestically and real investment offshore doesn't do anything for the Japanese economy. The Japanese Abe, the prime minister, then engaged in more austerity by raising sales taxes. And poof, there goes the real economy. And that's exactly what happened. It collapsed. Once again, flattened out the story. I mean, there have been four bona fide recessions in Japan since 2008. Four. They're heading for the fifth. Right? And what you will see relative within the next 12 months is another round of QE to get their stocks going again. They got a little push on the stocks, but not that much. And again, the whole idea with QE and monetary injection is to get the stock market up, to get the valuations, the equity valuations of these companies up, presuming that once it gets up, companies will be more inclined to invest. Because their stock market and valuations are up, right? They got extra cash from the market valuations, and now they'll be so inclined to invest. See, that's the strategy with all this monetary focus, right? Boost the markets, the financial markets, and businesses will then invest, and then the real economy will follow. But it's not happening. You see, it didn't happen in the U.S. The U.S. did all its QE and zero interest rates since 2008, and what happened? Oh, the money goes into financial assets, goes into the stock and bond markets, flowed offshore into emerging markets, right? Or it was returned to U.S. investors in stock buybacks and dividend payouts, and or the rest of the, they're just sitting on it, cash hoarding, right? Massive amounts of money capital was created here with this QE, but it all went to the very top, you see. It did not trickle down into real investment, creating real jobs, expanding real jobs, real investment, real wages, real income, real consumption, GDP recovery. See, that's the theory, but it didn't happen that way. It didn't happen that way in the U.S., still hasn't happened. It didn't happen that way in Japan, and it's not going to happen that way in Europe. They introduced their QE earlier in this year. $1.2 trillion equivalent. Look, they got a little boost out of the stock market. Other events intervened here, and the stocks in Germany and elsewhere have flattened down again. So they got a little bit of a boost. Not even as much of a boost in stocks that the U.S. did from its QE, you see. And, of course, the Japanese got a little bit more, but that flattened out too. So this whole strategy, neoliberal strategy of monetary policy, where if you boost the valuations and the incomes of the rich, some of it will trickle down monetarily. Not happening. Let's go back to the U.S. Massive QE, almost $5 trillion, just short of $5 trillion since 2008. They did discontinue that at the end of 2013, but they've kept the 0.15% interest rates for banks ever since 2008. And, of course, the banks go and borrow that free money. And what do? And now it's, of course, the shadow banks as well. Well, they invested where the returns are greatest. Where their returns greatest? In financial asset markets. Or, for a while, in emerging markets in China. But that's turning off now. They're not doing that as much. So, you know, the only thing keeping the stock markets up and growing and bond markets have been all this free money. It's not based on true valuations of what's going on in the companies and the stock market. It's just all the free money, massive liquidity has been created. And, I mean, watch the U.S. Dow Jones market. What happens? Every time it should correct at least 5 to 10%, it goes down about 3%. And then all this free money on the sidelines rushes in and back up go to stocks. You see, it's a total falsified market here, totally distorted market in the U.S. and in China now. You know, as I said before, China not using QE but other measures also had the same effect, redirect all this money into the stock market, as I said, as a way of boosting private investment and therefore hopefully jobs and consumption income that would keep the whole thing going. But it's not happening. It's not going into real investment. It's going into financial speculation, or it's going into stock buybacks. I think I talked in a previous show here how much corporate profits have risen since 2010. And if you look at corporate profits in the U.S. and take the level in 2008 and say how much above 2008 each year profits have increased in the U.S. for the last six years, okay? We don't have 2015 figures yet, but we have up through 2014. So 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, how much have profits increased officially? Corporate profits, of course. I'm not talking about non-incorporated businesses. Corporate profits, over $5 trillion. Yeah, $5 trillion increase in corporate profits since 2008, over 2008 levels. How much have businesses diverted, distributed back to their top shareholders? About $5 trillion. You know, if you look at stock buybacks, U.S. stock buybacks, and the U.S. dividend payouts, just for the largest S&P Standard & Poor's 500 companies in the U.S., what do you get? You get about $5 trillion accumulated dividend payouts and stock buybacks. $5 trillion profits, $5 trillion distribution. Okay, did they distribute all of their profits? No, of course not. Right? They're still sitting on some, and a lot of it was redirected elsewhere, to other financial markets and emerging markets around the world. Okay, so where do you get the rest of that money from? Well, with interest rates so low, it drove down other bond rates, corporate bond rates, to record lows as well. So companies, corporations, issued massive amounts of new corporate stock. Massive amounts. Investment-grade corporate bonds, right? Junk-grade corporate bonds, and a number of other commercial paper and so forth. You know, they pumped all this money, raised all this money from all this bonds, about $5 trillion. So they made $5 trillion in profits. They raised another $5 trillion in corporate bond issuance, so that's about $10 trillion. They gave back about half of that, $5 trillion. What did they do with the other half? Well, they're either sitting on it, right, or they invested it abroad. You know, very little got invested in the U.S. as a result, you see. And that's the picture in the U.S. That's what monetary policy, QE, and zero interest rates virtually have produced here. And as a result, you get a very weak real economic recovery and no economic recovery in Japan or in Europe as a result. In contrast to that, what do we see in China after 2008? Well, we see a massive fiscal stimulus, 15% of their GDP at the time, and a massive monetary accompanying stimulus. And what happened to China? We had this huge recovery in China, snap back, right? They did not rely on QE and monetary policy. Yes, they had money injection, but it was from traditional forms of injection by a government banking system that accompanied and financed massive government investment. So, you know, their economy, real economy, snapped back to 10-14% annual GDP growth rates, you see. But that's not sustainable long term. And that's why we're seeing this shift, China trying to turn to a private investment and private consumption, but neither are working very well. Because at the same time, China's trying to battle the shadow banks and keep the speculators down. And every time they do that, as I said, they slow down their real economy. You know, it's been a stop-go kind of a thing with them. But in the long run, their economy is slowing as a result. Okay. So that's the picture in China, and that's the picture in the USA. If you look at the USA, you know, what do we have in terms of the economy, picture in the economy? Well, you know, the dollar is rising. Long-term interest rates are already rising. The Fed will, perhaps in September, more like December, raise short-term rates as well. And in anticipation of this, money is already flowing from the emerging markets, including China, back to the U.S. All this massive money injection that flowed out of the U.S. after 2008 helped fuel the expansion in the emerging markets, along with China demand for commodities helped fuel the expansion, right? All that money now is, not all, but a lot of it is flowing back out of emerging markets, right? In other words, the U.S. is exporting its slow growth and recession to emerging markets now. They benefited from the money injection by the U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank and the Bank of England, U.K. That's been pretty much like the 51st state of the U.S. economically. Whatever the U.S. does policy-wise, they do as well. In fact, the U.K. is now talking about raising their interest rates, maybe even before the U.S. does. But they're in lock sync here with the U.S. on raising rates. They were in lock sync on QE when it occurred. Both the UK and U.S. Discontinued their QE early. And, of course, Japan and in Europe, continental Europe, just introduced recently their QE late. In the U.S., this is going to slow down manufacturing even more. U.S. manufacturing is flat in the U.S. Exports are declining, right? So any contribution to U.S. GDP from exports is probably going to be negative going forward. You know, we had an economy that collapsed 0.7 of 1% in the first quarter, revised to 0.2. We're going to see soon that the second quarter was not a 4% snapback, but maybe a 2%, right? Unlike last year, we had the same thing last year. We had a collapse of the economy in the second quarter, but then we had a 4%, first quarter rather, 4% recovery. Well, pretty good snapback. Well, I talked about that on my blog, how that was not sustainable in the third quarter of last year. And, of course, it wasn't because less than 6 months later, the U.S. economy was contracting again. See, the U.S. economy is in a stop-go mode. When it's growing for two, three quarters, it's at less than half of its normal recovery rate from recessions. But then it collapses to zero or below. This has happened four times in the U.S. It's going to happen again. That's what I call it a stop-go trajectory. Whereas Europe and Japan are in a lower level stop go. In other words, when they stop, they go into recession, a short shallow recession. When they go, they barely get above zero GDP growth rate, 0 to 1%. That's the picture in Europe and in Japan. Japan's even worse, right? So these two other main sectors of advanced economies, Japan and Europe, are performing even below the U.S. and U.K., right? And up until 2014, China and emerging markets were booming. Well, now China and emerging markets are slowing, and in some cases, like Brazil and other BRIC countries, they're in recession, and they're going lower. you know, all the oil commodity producing companies, countries are in recession, and others are slowly drifting in the same direction, you know, Indonesia, Turkey, and so forth. These are intermediate sized economies, the best of the emerging markets, you might say, but they're slowing too. So emerging markets are slowing everywhere. And they're going to, as U.S. rates go up and as U.S. interest rates go up, the dollar goes up. And if the value of the dollar goes up, their currencies, emerging market currencies, go down, right? There's an inverse relationship between global oil prices as well, so and the dollar and interest rates. So if the dollar interest rates go up, global oil tends to go down, which it is again. Those countries heavily dependent on oil commodity exports are particularly hard hit. You know, like Nigeria and Indonesia, Venezuela, and even Russia, right? Very dependent on oil exports. So they collapse even further. And that's the picture out there. Those countries are heavily dependent on commodity exports. Are in deep trouble. Their economies are in recession already. And, of course, the picture as China slows, which was the big commodity gobbler, you know, the demand for emerging market commodity goods is even less. And as Europe and the U.S. sort of stagnate, falter, the demand for their commodities by those sectors weakens as well. So you have a collapse in global commodities prices everywhere. Right? As the dollar goes up, I said the currencies go down in these emerging markets. You would think, well, if the currencies are down, it would stimulate exports, right? Well, that's not happening because that's not all that's required to stimulate exports, i.e. the currency decline and therefore your products are cheaper. What's really required is demand for those commodities and intermediate good exports from emerging markets. And with Europe and Japan and the U.S. not in any great situation in terms of increased demand for imports of commodities, semi-finished goods from these emerging markets, it doesn't matter how much you reduce your currency values, you're not going to stimulate exports. Plus, you know, when you have lower currency and higher dollar, in the U.S., money capital flows out, and you need money capital to finance exports. Money capital flows out of these emerging markets, and that's what's happening, too, right? Currencies are down, right? But the money capital is flowing out, and as interest rates rise in the U.S., it will leave those economies to the higher rates in the U.S. So emerging markets are going to feel the real brunt here. I had predicted this was going to happen back in January 2014 in an article called The Emerging Global Perfect Storm. And then, of course, later that year, I wrote an article about the global oil price deflation. These are two major developments on a global scale that are driving the global economy slower. Different paces in different countries, depending on commodity mixes and the currency strength and so forth. But the long-term trend is for emerging markets, including China, to significantly slow. Right? At the same time, we look at what's the trend in Europe and Japan, at best stagnation, at best. And in fact, you could say their policies, their mutual policies of monetary QE in both Europe and Japan, represent a kind of dueling QEs, you might say. Dueling QEs. Both Japan and Europe are rolling the dice on the idea of QE, massive money injections, which would drive down their currencies, right, and increase their exports. It's QE is really designed to drive down the currencies to reduce exports. Also, as I said before, to maybe stoke their stock equity stock markets to get some domestic investment out of it. Right. Although the stock markets recoveries in both Japan and Europe have stalled, so you know, forget that. right? But they're still betting on currency depreciation, you know, devaluation of the currency of the currency by means of monetary policies. Supplementing that is also a third element in Europe and Japan, and that is what's called internal devaluation. In other words, reduced wages and labor costs significantly. Labor market reforms, they call those, right? So labor market reforms to drive down wages and benefits and so forth to make their products more competitive for export, right? Monetary injection to drive down the value of their currency to also make it more competitive in the world for exports, and then hopefully boost the stock market and increase domestic investment. But none of those three elements are really working in the case of Japan and Europe. So what are these two doing? They're engaging in dueling QEs here. You know, Japan did it first in 2014, and then here earlier this year, Europe followed. You're going to see another QE in Japan here, probably maybe before the end of the year, but certainly 2016. And then you'll see another QE in Europe, right? What this all means is the global capitalist system is not functioning very well, and they got it on life support by massive money liquidity injections to keep it from collapsing even further. I mean, behind the scenes of what appears to be a recovery is this very, very sick global economy that requires massive money liquidity injections by central banks just to keep going. How long can they do that? Well, some bourgeois economists say that, all that massive money injection is going to create inflation, right? Those are the monetarists, or what I call retro-classicalists in my new book coming out, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, also by Clarity Press. This is my big theoretical explanation of what's going on. So all this massive liquidity injection, how much has been since 2008? Well, if you look at the figures, look at the advanced economies. I'm not even talking about emerging economies because it's hard to get the data. The U.S., Canada, U.K., Eurozone, Europe there, right, and Japan, right? How much liquidity has been injected? Over $9 trillion just in QE, quantitative easing, and rising, right? Rising in Europe and Japan. $9 trillion in free money. In other words, printed money. The government, central banks print the damn money, and they take that money and they buy these bonds from investors, institutional investors, and who knows at what price they're buying these bonds. They're just sucking up these bonds from private investors at fire sale prices and subsidizing investors. That's injecting all this extra liquidity, money capital, into the system. But that's not the only way they do this. The other way is virtually zero interest rates. Banks can borrow for free from the Federal Reserve and other central banks, 0.15% or some ridiculous low amount, right? Token. You add all that up with the $9 trillion plus QE, and you got about $20 to $25 trillion has been pumped into the global economy in monetary means. And what have we gotten for that mountain of money? We got a molehill recovery, really. The U.S. is the best of all the worst, you might say. Virtually nothing in Japan and Europe, right? U.K. got a boost, but that was from a lot of Chinese money coming into real estate and infrastructure, right, into the U.K. Now that has dissipated, and the U.K. economy is slowing once again. So it was a false real estate boom, you know. So has this caused inflation? No. Everywhere in real goods and services, prices have been drifting lower and deflating. Big problem, both in Japan and in Europe, because if prices are deflating, businesses don't invest. You know, why should I invest at certain costs today when the products I think I'm going to sell 6 months from now are going to be even lower in price? uncertainty. I'm not going to invest, you see. So deflation, declining deflation, means less real investment going on, and less jobs and income, and therefore less consumer demand, and therefore more goods deflation. Oh, but where did this $25 trillion go? It went into financial bubbles, financial asset investment and inflation. That's where it went. Money produces inflation, excess money, but in financial assets, because that's where it went. It did not go into goods and services. It did not go into wages and increase consumer demand to raise the price of goods. We have a bifurcated economy now. We have global finance capital. We have all these massive liquidity markets all over the world, and a massive amount of liquidity has been created in the last 40 years, accelerated in the last 8. And it's all flowing, a lot of it's flowing into financial assets for speculation, right? And because it's so much profitable, financial speculation and financial bubbles, right, it's sucking money out of what would have gone into real investment to create, jobs, income, and consumer demand. It's being diverted, right? Distorted and diverted into financial assets. We have a globalized financial economy now. Finance capital and finance capital elite are running the show. Right? And it's having a big negative impact on capitalism itself, its ability to create and sustain real growth, that requires real jobs and so forth. At the same time, even on the real side, they're cutting. On the real side, they're cutting as well. They're cutting wages and so forth in all kinds of ways. I talked about Europe and Japan labor market reforms, right? Well, they've instituted labor market reforms here already, and they're continuing them. They don't call it that, but look, wages have been declining, real wages, so badly that now they're even talking about, well, we got to do something about minimum wage. We've got to get these wages up. Well, unions used to be able to push the wages up in good times. But the unions have been destroyed. The private sector unions are essentially gone in the U.S., except maybe for transport. There are unions, but, they're not getting much, if anything, in wage increases. There's no strikes. There's no fights, and they're losing ground every year across the board in terms of pensions and health care and so forth. Unions have not been able to protect their members in terms of wages and benefit concessions. So, they provide some protection in terms of rights on the job and a little bit of job security, but in terms of the big gains they used to produce in terms of wages and benefits, no, don't exist, right? And big attacks on pension systems in the U.S. and globally everywhere. Take back those deferred wages that were paid. Right? Exploitation takes new forms. It's not just low-wage payments and productivity speed-ups and so forth. Lengthening the workday, all that's going on. But there's new secondary forms of exploitation. Capitalists are reaching back and taking even the minimal wages they paid you once, taking it back again. Right? And that's called, pension cuts, benefits, benefit cuts. That's called privatized the healthcare system, Obamacare, right? Make you sustain your consumption by taking on more debt, which is just a way of saying you're going to have to pay us interest in the future, so we're laying claim to your future wages, you see. We're taking away your future wages. That's what debt is, consumer debt. So all these new forms of holding down wage growth and so forth is also having a negative effect on the ability to consume. Right? The jobs being created, they talk about 5.5% unemployment in the U.S., but hey, they're mostly part-time temp contractor jobs or low-wage jobs. Yeah. And your hours are being cut. So no wonder we can't get real disposable income growth going in this country, which means that you're not stimulating demand that much. And therefore consumption, with two-thirds of the economy in the U.S., is not playing a very big role. In fact, just the opposite, right? Big problem. with consumption. And part of it has to do with all the diversion of investment into financial assets, which are more profitable for the elite. And part of it has to do with all these changes in the labor markets at the same time. Well, in my new book, I talk about this. I have chapters on financial restructuring that's been going on for 40 years and labor market restructuring going on for 40 years. And you know, labor market restructuring means lowering labor costs and wages and income and so forth. That's why consumption is so weak. At the same time, financial restructuring, diverting capital into financial investments rather than into real investments. And all of those two together explain why we have this huge inequality growth continuing. You know, wage incomes are stagnant and declining, except for the top 10% and tech and so forth, right? At the same time, capital incomes are booming. You know, I talked about $5 trillion in buybacks for just in the U.S. for 500 largest companies. You know, if you put it all together, all the buybacks and all the dividend payouts for all the companies in the U.S., you'd probably be around $8 or $9 trillion distributed since 2010. 2009, 2010. Somebody got very, very rich off of all this, right? It wasn't us. Right? We're struggling with part-time jobs and all the other labor market changes and benefit cuts and so forth, right? So, you know, all this talk about wage increases in the U.S., oh, we finally got some wage recovery going. Well, you know, that includes the wealthiest. It's all skewed to the top, wealthiest 10%, you know. Folks in tech, as I said, and some other industries may be getting some wage increases. And, of course, wages mean salaries and bonuses. That's part of wages. And the other thing that people don't realize is that the government data, when they report wage increases, you know, they are assuming business income, you know, non-incorporated income. If you're a small business person, a proprietorship, partnership, right? 65% of all your income is considered wages, right? So if you're a small business and doing well, your, quote, wages rise. If you look at hourly wages for production and non-supervisory workers, about 110 million in the U.S., you'll see that real wages have not been rising. And then if you look at median family income, weekly income, median family, you know, $50,000 a year annual income, that's been declining 1-2% a year for 6 or 7 years now. Okay. And then we're going to have more layoffs here. You know, if you look at the U.S., a lot of GDP growth was centered in this oil patch, this oil shale patch, in certain parts of the country, but now that's collapsing as the Saudis take on the shale producers in the U.S., and also very localized. It's not generalized throughout the country. So consumption is not going to do that well. In the U.S., investment, as I said, is being diverted. Now, of course, we got the collapse of the shale investment. Capital expenditures, in oil patch was and rail transport was a big piece of that, and now that's collapsing as well. Housing, it's all multifamily production. As people got thrown out of their homes, apartment building is a big thing now. That's the only thing driving housing in the U.S. We're going to see some foreign demand to also drive housing in the U.S. as all this money flows out of Asia back to the U.S., speculating in high-end homes and so forth, right? And then, of course, U.S. manufacturing and exports is flat. Dollar's going to go up. Rates are going to go up further, flatten it more out. Household spending is kind of stagnant. I mean, where is this great picture of the U.S. economy? And the U.S. is the best of this worst, all the worst. I mean, Europe is worse, Japan is worse, China is slowing, emerging markets are falling into recession left and right, going to get even worse as the dollar goes up, right? Where's the growth? Where's this great recovery, this global recovery? You know, don't listen to the and read the headlines in New York Times because it's all BS. Beneath it is a very, very weak and fragile global economy that never really recovered from the crash of 2008-09. The crisis was shifted to Europe and Japan, and the emerging markets boom, China boom, but now it's morphing again. It's shifting into a third phase, and that's where China emerging markets bear the brunt of the crisis, And Europe and Japan just continue to stagnate, and the U.S. keeps bouncing around the stop-go. That's the picture. In the meantime, we have all the financial bubbles around the globe. And next week, we'll talk about these financial bubbles in more detail. You know, what are they and where are they occurring? What's happening with bonds, junk bonds? What's happening with stock markets? What's happening with exchange-traded funds? And all this other speculative plays that are being played out. So join us next week, and we'll look at the financial side of the fragile global economy. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions.